So this is the Quantum Foundations course. I say that because, given what I'm about to say next, you may not realize it. So imagine you have a factory. Okay. You'll find during this course that my artwork isn't the best. But, okay, here's a factory. This is a sort of pre-carbon zero factory. And the factory makes bombs. So here's a bomb. Okay. And every bomb has on it a handle. This is a handle. And it also has a trigger. Here's the trigger. Okay. And the trigger is so incredibly sensitive that if a single particle of any kind whatsoever, photon, electron, whatever, impinges on the trigger, then the bomb will explode. Okay. However, the manufacturing process in this factory is imperfect, so that a significant fraction of the bombs end up looking like this. The trigger is simply missing. Okay. And the question is, how do you establish that you have a bomb with a trigger? So we're going to call the bombs that have triggers good bombs. And the bombs that don't have triggers, bad bombs. I put inverted commas around because of the moral ambiguity. And the question is, can we find out that we have a good bomb, but without exploding it? Okay, is it possible to have a process whereby we know we have a good bomb, but we haven't exploded it? Now, it's okay if we explode some of the good bombs, as long as we don't explode all of the good bombs. Okay. Okay, and it would seem that this is impossible, because the only way to find out if the trigger is here is by sending a particle, a photon, something like that, to look and see if the trigger's there. But if you do that, you explode the bomb. Okay. So this is the Elitzur Weidman bomb problem. And I'll return to it at the end of the lecture. Just out of curiosity, how many people have heard of this problem? Two. Okay, it's a bigger fraction than usual. Okay, so if you know this, the answer, don't blurt it out. Okay, good. So this lecture is on quantum foundations. So this seminar, this series, sorry, this lecture course, this course is on quantum foundations. There isn't really a good book on this subject, at least one that's suited for the course I'm going to give. But you will find lots of lectures on PERSA. So if you go back, you'll find lectures that I've given in the past, which will be similar to the ones I'm going to give this time around. You'll also find lectures that have been given by Rob Speckens and also by Matt Leifer. So feel free to go and look at those. So I have office hours scheduled for, I think it's 1 o'clock on Fridays. My office is 4:59, so I'll be there for an hour on Fridays. Okay. One other comment before I start. So I try to keep this course simple, at least at the technical level, because the focus is to be on the conceptual issues. If you have questions, feel free to interrupt. I prefer that style of lecturing, so please interrupt if you have questions. Okay, so this first lecture will be on interferometers. And the reason I like interferometers is because they're a very good way to get to grips with the basic framework of quantum theory and to see that you have very simple systems, and you can see the sort of Hilbert space structure laid bare. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the rules for how to do calculations with an interferometer, and then we'll go through a few examples. And in the first place, I'm going to talk about single particle interferometers. Okay, so first of all, imagine we have a source. So this is some kind of box that has a button on it, and you press the button, and a single particle is released, and we'll label the path. We'll give the paths labels with these lowercase letters. So this one is labeled S. Okay. Next, if you have a length, you have a path that has a certain length, the associated with this preparation is a ket, okay, which I'll just, since it's all S, which I'll just write that like that. Okay, so this is the state that's produced by this device. Now, if we allow the particle to travel along some length of path, we'll denote it by, we'll say you accumulate a phase shift, a phase factor. And so what happens is the path, this is path A. You go from A to E to the I L over lambda. Sorry, lambda. There should be a 2 pi in there as well. That's the phase factor that you incur. OK. Next, a phase shift. Phase shifter, so you have some length of path, then you have a phase shifter, and so what happens is now you just go like this. So typically, if you're doing, for example, photonics, you have your particles are photons, then the phase shifter can be a piece of glass, and you vary the thickness to vary the phase. Okay. And next, a mirror. So you have some device that can change the direction the path is going in. And I'm going to put an I factor here. This doesn't really matter, actually. This could just be the same thing. The different mirrors are built in different ways, and you could accumulate any arbitrary phase. But then by varying the path lengths around, you can absorb it. So just as a more or less as a convention, I'm going to put an I factor in front of mirrors. And that the reason I do that is because for a beam splitter, that convention is also useful when you have reflection. I'll come to that in next. So this is a mirror. So next, a beam splitter. So this is a beam splitter. In the case of photons, it would be a piece of glass which had been partially coated with silver on one of the two sides. And then you have the different paths, A and B, going in. C and D coming out. And now we want to say what A and B go to. So we send A in, what does it go to? Send B in, what does it go to? And you can write it like this. Okay. So A comes in, it has, you have two terms. So one which goes through has a square root of t. The beam splitter has these two, the transmissivity and the reflectance associated with it. So the part that goes through, which is square root of t times this, the ket associated with this path. And then you have an I associated with the reflection and the square root of r. So that's what happens with A, and B is like this, the same idea. These I factors, you don't have to choose, you could have some different choice, but does anyone know what's particular about this particular transformation? Anyone see what's special about it? Okay. So the key point is that it's unitary.
Unitary.
Okay. That means these two states, they start off orthogonal. And if you take the inner product of these two states, you'll still get orthogonal states. Okay. And you can see that if you just take the inner product. So let me do that. So it's the inner products. So I'm taking the conjugate of this one. Now, if you multiply this through, you'll see you get the terms that contribute are the ones which have C cross D. So this is equal to zero. Those are orthogonal. So if you do the calculation, you'll see that because you've got this I, you get a cancellation, so this whole thing is zero. Okay. And there was a point when the literature was, every now and then you'd get somebody write a paper or a preprint where they had a non-unitary transformation for the beam splitter. And if you do that, you can do all sorts of wonderful things like signal faster than the speed of light. And so those people would then claim a Nobel Prize. So it's really important that you get that you have a unitary transformation here. Okay. Any questions so far? So very simple, like I promised. Good. Okay. Let's just say for these beam splitters, you have T plus R equals 1. This is the assumption that the beam splitter is lossless. Which I'm going to assume. So next we have detectors. So the particle impinges on this device and the detector fires. And mathematically, I'll write this like this. So this is meant to be the ready state. The detector. So the detector is initially ready to detect a particle. Particle comes in, and then the detector fires, and it absorbs the particle. Okay. You can also have detectors like this. So the particle passes through the detector fires, and then the particle continues out the other side. These kinds of detectors are actually very difficult to build, but they're a useful theoretical device. You can build them, but it's difficult. In that case, you go from the detector being in the ready state to the detector clicking, just like that. Okay. So now I want to go through a number of really simple examples of interferometers. So let's start off with the simplest example, the zero. Example. So you start off with a source. For a certain source here, a certain type of particle, and a detector. If you press the button, then the detector will fire. First example, is a beam splitter . So there's a beam splitter. Okay, so we have initially a particle going into the beam splitter, and we have two detectors, both in the ready state. And now we can evolve through the beam splitter . Okay, so we get that, and now we can evolve so that this particle hits one of the two detectors. Get that. Okay. Okay, and so now we can look at this and we can make some predictions for what's going to happen. So we have that the probability of seeing the detector B fire and seeing detector C not fire is the square modulus of this amplitude here. And that just equals R. Uh, And then we can do it the other way around. The probability of seeing C not fire, sorry, B not fire, C fire, is equal to the square modulus of this amplitude, which is just T. So that's what you expect. The probability of the particle being detected here is just equal to the transmissivity of this beam splitter. The probability of it being detected here is equal to the reflectance. There's two more probabilities you can calculate. The probability that neither detector fires is equal to the probability that both detectors fire. Is equal to zero. And that's because there's no terms in this expansion that that correspond to that. Okay. So this is obviously incredibly simple, but there's already something quite deep happening here. Because if you look at this, this is the description of what's happening in quantum theory. Well, then you have something associated with path B, you have a certain amplitude, and you have a certain amplitude associated with path C. So if you like, the particle comes in, then you have an amplitude associated with each of these two paths, and then suddenly only one of the two detectors click. Okay. If detector B clicks, then it's impossible for detector C to click. And if detector C clicks, then it's impossible for detector B to click. What you have here is really a simple version of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument. So in 1935, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen put out an argument arguing for the incompleteness of quantum theory. They argued that if nature is local, then quantum theory is incomplete. And in fact, several years earlier, 1927, Einstein had made a similar argument using essentially this kind of situation. And here's the argument. The particle, it comes in, you have the amplitude associated with each of these paths, or a wave associated with each of these paths. And then one clicks, and then suddenly this one can't click. So that doesn't seem possible because that would imply a non-local influence. Okay. So how does this one know not to click suddenly? Now, one way to resolve this is to say, well, what actually happens is a particle comes in, and the particle goes one of two directions, say this way. You could say the particle comes in, and then the particle goes this way. And that's why this one clicks and this one doesn't click. The only problem with that explanation is that it doesn't appear in the state. There's nowhere in this quantum state where you have a particle in one of the two paths. The quantum state tells you that you have an amplitude associated with each of the two paths. Okay. So I'm going to go into more detail into the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument later in the course. I just wanted to flag already at this very simple level you have this issue. Any questions at this stage? No? Yeah.
So how exactly is this, are the states that A naught, how is it exactly defined, the state before detected?
Oh, A naught, how is it defined? Like in this example.
So
to answer that question, I think you'd want to build a model of your detector. Okay, I mean, a simple model would be where you imagine this is sort of an atom waiting to be excited. Although a more sophisticated model might involve a larger number of sort of atoms or something in some sort of state that's ready to be excited. So to really answer that question, you'd have to build a model. But what we do know is that when a detector clicks, it goes from being in one state where it's ready to click, but it hasn't clicked, to being in another state And those are orthogonal states. So in quantum theory, they're represented by orthogonal cats. So that much we know, even without going into the detail of how we model the detector. So I'm not sure that's a satisfactory answer to your question, but it's a... often you don't need to look into the detail of how something is modeled because you know quantum theory has to model it in a certain kind of way. But you could do it if you wanted. Yeah, go ahead.
If the photon was going in the opposite direction, would you have the same equations or the inverse of the equations?
If the photon was going from the detector to the source?
Or if you basically did things the other way around.
Oh, right. So you're just...
if you turned everything around, would you get an inverse or would you get the same equations?
So, okay, good. So, so a photon traveling in this direction along the path versus one traveling against the arrow, that would be represented by a different ket. Let me call it a tilde. And these two things would be orthogonal.
Okay.
Yeah. They would have different momenta associated with them. Okay. One other thing I should comment on here is I'm sort of assuming a single mode. I'm assuming these particles have a frequency which is pretty precisely defined. You can relax that assumption and still pretty much everything I say goes through. It's a little bit like the phase shift, for example. If you don't have a unique lambda, the phase shift will be slightly more complicated, but it doesn't affect things very much. Okay. Any more questions? So let me move on to the interferometer. This is my second example. Okay. So I have a particle, it comes in from a source. I press the button, it comes in. It meets one beam splitter. It can go this way or this way. Then it can pass through these phase shifters that are in the internal paths. Then it meets a second beam splitter. Then it can travel along path C towards detector C or along path D towards detector D. Okay. And you can do the calculation for that using the tools that I laid out. And I think something like this might be one of the homeworks. Is that right? Yeah, okay. This one is a little bit more complicated because it's got the phase shifters in. But I think it's just in terms of understanding what's going on here, it's useful to look at a simpler example where you have... no phase shifters. Okay. Okay. So let's do this calculation. We're assuming that these path lengths inside are equal. So we start off in the state S, I'm just going to keep this simple. I won't bother putting in the kets for the detectors because you'll see what happens anyway. Now this goes through the first beam splitter, and we're going to assume that these beam splitters are 50-50. So T and R are both equal to 0.5. So what happens is you have this after the first beam splitter. So you get reflected into U, so you pick up this I factor. The amplitudes are both equal to 1 over root 2 in magnitude. And now next, you want to evolve now through the second beam splitter. Both of the mirrors just insert a phase of I, but that's the same for both paths. I'm just going to ignore that. It doesn't really matter, just to keep it simple. So now let's go take it through each of the beam splitters over here. So U goes to a superposition of C and D. With appropriate factors in front. Because U is reflected into D, you pick up an I. And now V, it's the same story. But now the I is on the C instead, because C is transmitted into D but reflected into C. Okay. And now, if you can calculate what that is equal to, you'll see that there's 1 over root 2 with an I on top of it times this 1 over root 2. There's another I, so you get a minus term in front of this D. Over here, you have a plus term, so they cancel, and you're just left with the C until you get C, and actually it has an I in front of it. So what that tells us is that every time we click the button here on this source, this detector will fire, and this one will never fire. Okay. Okay. So another example, which is I think it's interesting to consider, just to compare the two. Which is where you put a phase shifter in front, and the phase shift, you make it so that the phase shift is equal to pi. Okay. So you accumulate, when the particle goes through there, you get an I phase factor. But if you do the calculation, the same calculation I did, but take into account this phase shift of pi, then you'll find that S goes to D. Okay. Instead of going to C. And I can't remember, I'm not sure whether there's an I in front of here or not. Okay. So now we have, if we look at these two interferometers, we have an argument that something goes along both paths of the interferometer. This is very basic, and you've probably seen this argument in the context of the double slit experiment, but I think it's cleaner in the context of this. These are Max Zender interferometers. It's much cleaner in the context of the Max Zender interferometer. So let's try to explain this these predictions using a particle model. Remember, in this case, we were able to explain what happened just thinking in terms of a particle going this way or this way. That didn't fit necessarily with the quantum description, but nevertheless, we can do it. So let's try to explain what happens here in terms of just a particle model. So now we have a particle comes in, it gets to this beam splitter, now it makes a 50-50 choice. Sorry, this one, yeah. It gets to this beam splitter, it makes a 50-50 choice whether to go this way or this way. Okay. Let's imagine, for the sake of argument, it goes this way. Okay. And then it arrives at this beam splitter, and now it has to make a choice whether to go this way or this way. Okay. Well, that particle, since it didn't travel along the top path, it doesn't know whether it's in this situation or this situation. Okay. So it doesn't know whether there was a phase shifter here or not. If there is a phase shifter, then it better go into D. Detector D had better verifier. And if there isn't a phase shifter, then C had verifier. But since the particle didn't go along the top path, it doesn't know whether the phase shifter there is there or not. And so that particle model fails. So there's an argument that in some sense, something travels along both paths. Okay, any questions? Okay. Okay. There's another example. This is the third example. So this is an interferometer. Well, looks like an interferometer. Particle goes in like this. But now you insert a detector into each of the paths. So you click this button, the particle goes through. Now, in this case, you will not see interference. So in this case, the particle, when it arrives over here, will go 50% of the time to D, or let's assume these are 50-50 beam splitters. So then the particle will go half the time to C and half the time to D. And the reason is that you've made these measurements inside the paths. And it's instructive to go through and just do the calculation to understand why that happens. I won't do it now, but if you have some time, just sit down and do the calculation. The reason is because the state of these detectors end up being entangled with the state of the path, and that prevents the cancellation that we saw up here. Okay. So you don't get destructive interference. Okay. So now let's go to the Elitzur-Weidman bomb. Okay. So I want to solve the Elitzur-Weidman bomb problem. So among those of you that didn't already know the answer, do you see how to do this now? Okay. So so obviously it's going to use an interferometer. So what you do is you set up an interferometer of the first type up there, the one that has 50-50 beam splitters and no phase shifts. Okay. And if you do that and you send a particle in, then detector C will always click. Okay. Now what you do is you take the bomb that you want to test, take it very carefully, of course, by the handle, and you place it so that the trigger, if it's there, protrudes into one of the two paths, let's say the top path of the interferometer. Okay. And when you do that, one of three different things can happen. Okay. The first thing that can happen is that the bomb explodes. Okay. You can imagine the particle comes along here and hits the trigger, the bomb explodes. If the bomb explodes, then you know that you had a good bomb, but you no longer have a good bomb because it's exploded. Okay. So you haven't succeeded. The second thing that could happen is that detector C fires. Well, detector C could have fired had the bomb not been present. It would have fired had the bomb not been present. It doesn't tell you whether the trigger is present or not. It does, by the way, provide some partial information, but it doesn't tell you. The third thing that can happen is detector D fires. Okay. Now, if detector D fires, then you know that this path can't be open. You know that there must be a trigger here. And the reason you know that is because had there been no trigger here, then you would just have interference, and so the particle would come out in C. Okay. So so if detector D fires, then you know you have a good bomb. But you haven't exploded it. So that's the argument. Any questions on this? Yeah, go ahead.
If you had multiple paths through this device, so you kept splitting the beam more and more ways,
yeah,
doing the same experiment, would you get an improvement in terms of your ability to detect the blowing up?
So certainly people have played the game of trying to improve the ratio. I don't know that anyone's pursued that particular route. There's been other routes that have been pursued. So one thing you can do immediately is I talked here about having 50. One thing you can do immediately is if you end up in this situation, C fires but the bomb doesn't explode, you can send the particle back around and try again. And so if you're doing that enough times, you'll improve the
probability.
The probability. Yeah. Yeah. And you can do even better if you allow these beam splitters to be not to be 50-50, but to be some other. And in that case, you can get close to 50% minus delta by recycling. There is another way of doing it where you can get close to 100%, that's a homework problem, isn't it? I think so, anyway.
Maybe the tutorials.
Maybe the tutorial. Okay, a tutorial problem. Sorry. So maybe I won't sort of go into how that works at the moment. But there's a way of doing it, which and that was kind of shocking to some people that you get to almost 100%.
Is there somewhere where you can find the homework, or has it not been released yet?
Oh, you have to. I don't know. Is it?
What's the questions?
Is there some way to find the homework? It hasn't been released yet, I think, is the answer.
Oh,
the hasn't been released, yeah. But we'll discuss it.
Tutorials are on the portal.
Tutorials are on the portal. Okay.
On the what?
On the portal?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure if you, anyway. Maybe talk to. Okay.
Lucy?
Yeah.
So should we think of this bomb with the trigger inserted on the wire as one of these boxes that has wires coming out both sides? Is that the right?
I would think of it as the first kind. Because you can think of it as either kind if you want, it doesn't really matter.
Is that what you're talking about?
So I had two models for detectors, and you could think of it. You could think of it as either kind. I mean, the explosion is perhaps so big that I usually think of it as the first kind, but you can think of it as either kind. In some sense, what was clever about this paper by Litzer and Weidman is, it was a good idea, but they could have just called this a detector, and then nobody would have read the paper. But by calling it a bomb, they grabbed people's attention. It made it much more dramatic. I think that was a smart PR move. But yeah, you can mod it as either kind. Yeah, go ahead.
In your third example, you had two detectors, but you only really need one, because if one fires, you know the path, and if it doesn't fire, you still know the path.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I mean, for this kind of situation where you definitely have one particle in the interferometer, then that's the case. If you had, you know, if you didn't know if you had a particle or not in the interferometer, you might want something else. But yeah, but for this, it doesn't make a difference. Yeah. But I think pedagogically, it's clearer to have both detectors in there. So I'm just wondering, any more questions, discussions? And when I first came across this, I was lucky because my supervisor received a preprint of this paper when it first came out. And so, you know, I was able to follow up on it with some of my own research, but I found this very surprising, and it came out about 30 years ago. So this is a very simple effect, but it wasn't appreciated, I think, by people initially. Yeah. So you had another question?
Is there a way of obtaining these papers without paying $30 a shot?
So the Litzer-Weidman paper, I'm sure, is available if you just search on it. Maybe
they're old papers, so they're not on the archive.
They won't be on.
When I went searching for them, I couldn't find places where
okay.
They're available on the web. The University of Waterloo doesn't have a subscription with the publications.
Is it Foundations of Physics? I think it was in the end. Yeah, I've got a copy somewhere. I'll have to. I did manage to get one off the internet, but I don't remember how I did it. Maybe if you give me your email address, I can send it. Or if there's a place to put these somewhere for.
Put it on the portal. Okay.
It's a nice paper, actually. It's definitely worth reading because it's pretty straightforward.
It was more than just this paper. There's other papers as well. There's a whole collection of papers which you cite, which I couldn't find.
Right, I'm sorry about that. Yeah, okay.
Well, it's not your fault. It's
we can try and fix that, I think, is a good idea. It'd be nice to have all those available. So, yeah, go ahead.
You said that if C fires, we can't really tell anything about what happened, but if I'm trying to figure out how to make sure that, because we know how to see if D fires, then we know we have a good bomb, but how do you know we have a bad bomb? Because it seems like it should be if C fires, but it's not.
Yeah, so it's, if C fires, it could also fire because there's a good bomb there. The particle went this way, it reached this beam splitter, and then it just 50-50 went this way.
Okay, yeah.
So that doesn't tell you. It gives you some probabilistic information, but it doesn't tell you for certain.
Okay, so there's no way to find out if you don't have a bomb.
Yeah, someone asked this question last year, and I was stumped by it. But actually, there is a good way to find out if you have a bad bomb, which is just to send a particle directly onto the trigger, where the trigger should be.
Okay.
And if it doesn't explode, then you know.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. That's kind of the easier problem. But okay. I'm wondering if I should. So last year, I actually went through the calculation, and I think it may be worth doing. I have about 10 minutes left. I also wanted to talk about okay. Yeah, let me just go through the calculation. Okay. I don't know what I just did. Okay. Every now and then I touch this box and it starts bringing the screen up and down. Okay. Let's go through the calculation. So we have initially the particle, we have a bomb, which has not exploded, so I guess it's in the zero state. And then we have detectors B and C and D, like so. Okay. This goes to 1/2. It should be an I over root 2 U plus 1/√2 V times the same thing. Okay, and now there's two cases. The one where the case has no trigger, so I can maybe write a subscript, a superscript there to indicate no trigger. And if you have that case, then it just goes through as before, and you end up getting detector, so this should be D. You end up getting detector C clicks, okay? So that case is straightforward. The other case is where the bomb does have a trigger, so let me go through that case. So the next thing that happens is if the particle is in the U path, the bomb explodes. So you have an explosion. And I don't know how big this explosion is, whether it destroys the other detectors. It doesn't really matter. Let's say the other detectors survive. Be consistent with the ordering here. And so that's I/√2 plus now 1/√2. And then we have this term, which doesn't cause the bomb to explode. And it will now go through, we can evolve it if you want, straight through the second interferometer. I should do it in stages, so let's do it like that. Okay. So the next stage is okay, so now V evolves through the second beam splitter. And I'll just write the two terms down separately. So we have one term where it goes, it's transmitted through to D. So detector D fires. And you have another term where it's reflected into C. So detector C fires. Okay, so now we have these three terms. And now you can see, I've made a big mistake here, which is I forgot to include the bomb. Bomb is in the zero state. Okay. And so these are all the different outcomes I mentioned. And now you have this term here where detector D fires, and that's not possible if you have a bad bomb. Okay, so that's how it goes through. Okay, since I've got a few minutes, Let me talk about two-particle interferometry. Everything I did here was single particle interferometry, but you could easily have, you can easily consider a situation where you have two particles, so that then you might imagine you have two sources. Like so, and then you feed them into some apparatus, some interferometer perhaps. And there's lots of interesting examples of two particle interferometers. So one example is where you manage to get the particles, if you generate the particles in such a way that they travel out back to back. So you have some source for two particles, and you make it so they travel out back to back. So if this particle, so here's particle one, and here's particle two. So particle one is in one of these two paths, particle two is in one of these two paths. But the particles travel out back to back. So either particle one is in this path and particle two is in that path, or they're in this path and this path. So let's call it A1, B1, B2, A2. If you do that, the state is something like this. There could be some phase, but let's assume there isn't. And you can achieve this kind of thing by momentum conservation. Okay, if the two particles have a total momentum. The total momentum of the two particles is some constant, and then they separate. Then, by momentum conservation, they should move back to back. One thing that's interesting, I won't do this here, is to allow these two particles to interfere with themselves. Okay, I've running out of room here. Okay, and you can put a phase shifter here and here, say. And you can look and see what happens. And you'll find that you get some interference, but now it's two-particle interference. Okay. The amplitude, for example, the probability of detecting the particle here and here varies as a function of phi 1 plus phi 2. Okay, it's a sinusoidal function of phi 1 plus phi 2. So that's an interesting calculation to do. This interferometer, I think, was first proposed by Rarity and Tapster. And also, Shimony, Zeilinger, and Zhukovsky, I think. There's one more example, but it's 11:15. There's one more example of a two-particle interferometer which uses the Elitzur-Weidman bomb trick to get some interesting effects. But I'll talk about that on Wednesday.